On the grounds at EAA Air Venture, you're back now on EAA Radio Live.
Welcome back to the EAA Welcome Center. Just north of Celebration Way and west of ConocoPhillips Plaza. If you're on the grounds and you're hearing us now, please stop in at the Welcome Center and join us in the theater audience as we continue with segment two of this year's Aviation Journalists Roundtable. And we're joined now by Farid Guillot, who's the manager of electronic publications for EAA, including the e-newsletter's e-hotline, which I wait for every Thursday with rapt anticipation, and I'm not kidding. Experimenter, Vintage Aircraft Online, and Aviation Insider. Farid, thank you for stepping in, not as host today, but as guest and journalist.
That's easy. I just answer the questions this time.
Instead of asking them.
Less thinking.
Well, so thanks. Let's talk about the Pilot's Bill of Rights. So Senator James Inhofe's quote-unquote careless and reckless flying from earlier in the year when he landed on a closed runway and said, oh, you know, I just forgot to read the NOTAM, has brought about something good for aviation, perhaps, his Pilot's Bill of Rights, which was introduced on the Senate floor earlier this month. And now the bill has two dozen co-sponsors. And one news aggregator on the Internet says that this bill would protect pilots from agency overreach by the FAA in response to his own experience at the mercy of the FAA after he, quote, scared the stuff out of airport workers last year when he landed a Cessna on a closed runway. And he said, quote, this is Senator Inhofe, I was never fully appreciative of the feeling of desperation until it happened to me, close quote. So is this useful and is this overdue, or is this more about the senator than it is about the regulations?
There are some useful things in the Pilot's Bill of Rights as introduced by Senator Inhofe. Among them is minimizing or eliminating the presumption on the part of the NTSB that whatever the FAA says and does is correct in administrative procedures like pilot enforcement actions. Does anyone seriously think the senator's certificate was in question as a result of any of this?
On the other hand...
Is that a rhetorical question? Okay, a little point-counterpoint here.
On the other hand, he does refer to the Bob Hoover situation of a decade or so ago, and if you remember that, you know, Bob Hoover was sort of railroaded by a couple of FAA inspectors who felt, for whatever reason, that he, for some reason, after many, many years of flying airshow routines, was suddenly no longer fit to do so, and so they kept him from doing that by removing his medical certificate under, as I recall, an emergency revocation, and... he went to Australia and flew a bunch of airshow routines and proved to them that he was quite capable of safely flying them. And anyhow, just really got an administrative runaround by the FAA. And this Bill of Rights hopefully would provide some protection in that situation where the FAA, and from an enforcement standpoint, is kind of run amok. And there's really very little opportunity for pilots to have any sort of procedural protection from that.
I agree. And of course, there was a Hoover bill that was enacted back in 2000. It's part of another FAA authorization bill. There are valuable things in the Pilot's Bill of Rights. We'll see how it goes. It's going to be a freestanding bill. There's obviously the Senate version that Senator Inhofe introduced. There may be, in the near future, a House version of that same legislation. It's likely not going to get tacked on to any FAA legislation that's already in the pipeline, but who knows what happens next year.
So this year it wouldn't die in December?
It would not. It would continue through into next year, through the end of next year when that Congress adjourns.
Yep. Farid?
I think that a lot of people are quietly cheering on the effort behind this. Some people are a little uneasy about the way it came about because of the actions of the senator, however you want to judge the actions of the senator.
You almost wish it was anyone but Inhofe behind this.
Yes, and that's why, you know, so many people are kind of tiptoeing around this, although a lot of people are saying, that's what I've been thinking all this time. And so I think that it certainly opens the discussion. Is this the legislation that should be out there? I don't know. It's kind of like with the Passenger Bill of Rights. Born out of anger and disgust at a system that has been existed for a long time that we've always wanted to fix, but there are a lot of entrenched interests that seem to block it. But at the same time, if we go too quickly, then we might come up with a system that we're wishing for the old days of when the FAA just said, this is what you have to do to be in compliance again. And so the one thing I do think is that there is a one-sidedness to the enforcement system, and that certainly needs a light shone on it, because there is just really no recourse other than an administrative law judge. And maybe rarely every once in a while something would go above that to the Supreme Court. I can't cite a case, but I think there's maybe one or two times that it's gone beyond that one administrative law judge.
Are there any protections afforded to commercial pilots that would represent a note from the notebook that could be applied here, where there's maybe precedent? Or is this a completely different thing?
There is something called the ASAP program, and I can't remember what the exact words are, but it's a safety program that each operator chooses to buy into or not, and it's a very expanded version of the NTSB's reporting program. If you do something that you think might be enforceable, you can write into the NTSB, an accident reporting system. You can write that in, and for most things, you have a certain sense of immunity, and you can't be enforcement actions can't be put against you. That is expanded version of that is what a lot of commercial operators have for their pilots, because what it does is the actual data from these situations is more useful in a safety sense than actually going after these pilots and disrupting their careers and also the operations of these operators. So I think something like that could maybe be expanded to the general pilot population, but again, it would have to be looked at very carefully.
Hasn't there been some movement by some of the airlines, though, to dismantle their safety programs like that?
They go in and out about that, too, and they can't decide, and I don't know if it has to do with work rules between unions and management that could be part of what's playing into whether they participate in that or not, because I know from working for an operator, it was a national fractional ownership company. They were part of it, but another fractional ownership company decided they wanted out of it. And it had to do a lot to do with the work rules and whether the company was actually following the ASAP program.
Yeah. There's been a lot of proposals come and go about opening up the ASAP program for public access, and mm-hmm. NTSB has said they wanted access to it and all this kind of thing. And that, you know, kind of changes the rules in the middle of the game for that program, because it was put into place with anonymity as one of its cornerstones, that pilots and controllers and other aviation professionals can legitimately express concerns about certain practices and events they see, and report on it and have it evaluated independently of any enforcement action or any enforcement threats. So, I can certainly see where some carriers and even some pilot organizations would, from time to time, threaten to pull out of it.
But on the GA side, or it's really open to anybody, including controllers, the NASA Aviation Safety Reporting System, which I think you're referring to, credit to NASA and to the FAA for keeping that thing alive for the last 15 or 20 years, or however long it's been, because it's been threatened a few times too, and it really is a beneficial safety program that really is able to extract safety information out of pilots and give them a level of protection for being willing to report things that otherwise may never go reported, and therefore safety trends may never get uncovered.
Not only is it a valuable program for pilots who might have made an honest mistake, but it's also a very valuable program for those of us who are always interested in learning more about what really goes on out there in the system, and reading some of those reports can be very educational and help us all prevent us from doing certain things.
Yeah, if you hear us sort of speaking over things, there's some heavy equipment outside making a lot of noise, so pardon us if the noise is kind of coming and going.
Yeah, and it's not in the air, unfortunately. Otherwise, we'd excuse that out of hand.
Right. That we can deal
that's
with.
True. These have four wheels and a large empty space in the back with trash in it. We're talking with Jeb Burnside, who's the editor of Aviation Safety Magazine, Tom Haynes, who's the editor of AOPA Journal, and Farid Gio, who's the editor of the electronic publications family from EAA. And we're coming up on the end of the second segment of EAA Radio Live today, the Aviation Journalist Roundtable. We're going to talk in detail in our second half hour about safety. But before we end this segment, I want to ask you about the globalization of commerce Wow, that was a big dumpster.
That was well-timed,
well,
actually.
I was going to say, you're making your point, aren't you?
The globalization of commerce, you know, first it was, and this, they may not have been literally the first, but there was notably Epic Air, the turboprop single builder assist company, that entered a unique three-way partnership where one of the partners is a non-management or non-participating Chinese firm. Then Teledyne Continental Motors sells to AVIC. Then Cirrus sells to CAIGA, C-A-I-G-A, followed by a memorandum of understanding that the work and the jobs related to Cirrus will stay in Duluth. And then, of course, Cessna's principal place of manufacture of the 162 Skycatcher is Shenyang Aircraft Corporation in China. So here's the question. How is this going to play out? Will the economic center of gravity leave the United States? And how will we know when it did? Dum, dum, dum.
You're looking for a one-word answer?
Well, I figured that there might be more.
Well, let me just add one to the list, actually. Superior Air Parts was purchased by a Chinese company more than a year or so, I believe, out of bankruptcy. And so they're also basically Chinese-owned. So I don't know. I guess I can't really say whether it's good or bad. I mean, I guess in my mind, it's a shame that the U.S. investment community is so short-sighted and is unwilling to invest in what has been, you know, a part of American society and culture for, you know, 100 and what are we coming up on, 109 years or something like that. So it's a shame that we can't have U.S. companies investing in aviation, in the aviation community. I just wonder, you know, who's the next one to fall? When you look at all the turmoil that's going on with Cessna these days, and the change of management, and you know what's Textron on their parent company's patience, you wonder if Lycoming wouldn't be another logical spinoff from that company. And if the Chinese were to buy Lycoming, suddenly we'd find that all of our aircraft engines, Lycoming, Continental, and Superior, were essentially being manufactured in China. You know, and Rotax, of course, being in Europe. But so anyhow, I think it's going to be interesting to see what happens over the next year. But I do think that certainly this is just the beginning of a trend where we're going to see a lot of traditional U.S. companies being owned by foreign companies, maybe not all Chinese, but lots of foreign companies.
And I would think that the aircraft sector is still one of our strongest exports that we have and we have control over, where just a lot of other, certainly in the manufacturing sector, it's been diluted and moved either to Europe or now to Asia, which is definitely the power, or the BRIC nations, as you know, which is another emerging area. That is where the U.S. can maybe start to really hold that part down, because otherwise, you know, we've always been complaining about our trade deficit. But if we keep continuing to allow the bleeding of that, even in a manufacturing sector where we have probably the preeminent expertise in all phases, from training to design to operations, everything. The whole world emulates us in that respect, and then we're kind of slowly giving it away. But at the same time, that's where the demand is. But certainly, if you want to at least hold your ownership in one place, at least I guess the business community has to see that.
Yeah, I think the Chinese interest in and acquisitions of traditional general aviation companies based here in the U.S. is based on its own internal need for better transportation. I've never been to China, but I'm led to believe that there are a few well-developed road structures. The distances are great, and there's an increasing need as the Chinese economy matures for transportation. And as we all know, general aviation aircraft are uniquely suited to that particular role. Cirrus and Cirrus representatives have been involved in trying to market at least their individual aircraft, if not the whole company, to China for several years. I don't know about TCM, but if I were the Chinese and I was looking for an effective, inexpensive way to jumpstart my domestic infrastructure and my domestic transportation, buying a company like Cirrus would be a logical step.
We're going to talk about the so what of this situation after after we take a short break. You're listening to the Aviation Journalists Roundtable on EAA Radio Live.